Europe is experiencing the largest wave of refugees since World War II and is desperate to find a long-term solution. Join America Abroad for a town hall discussion linking New York to Berlin on iTunes and PRI.org/America Abroad.
A small Greek island shoulders a big burden today on the world. Migrants keep landing on the island of Lesbos, and so do the bodies of those who've drowned at sea. Island residents are overwhelmed, but they also want to help.
More and more people on Lesbos are getting involved and are really feeling this crisis and feeling these deaths.
Also, a reporter investigates an anti-communist group called The Front and its possible involvement in a string of unsolved murders.
5 Vietnamese American journalists get assassinated in the U.S., and in each case, there's suspicion that The Front is behind it.
Plus, we hear about the BBC newscaster who recorded this doomsday message.
Remember, there's nothing to be gained by trying to get away.
You can run, but you can't hide. Coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com. Brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let me ask you to try this brief mental exercise. Imagine the entire population of Newark, New Jersey, appearing on the shores of one tiny island, because that's what's happening on the Greek Isle of Lesbos. In the past year, residents there have struggled with the arrival of more than 300,000 desperate migrants.
It's overwhelming, and we cannot stand it anymore.
That's Lesbos resident Effie Latoudi. She's one of the volunteers helping to organize funerals for the migrants who die trying to reach the island. Reporter Jean Carstensen sat down with Latoudi today at a Lesbos refugee camp.
She was there sitting with some families, many of whom had lost children, had lost loved ones. This is the place where people go who are suffering these kinds of losses and are otherwise just really vulnerable.
And when did things get so bad that they needed volunteers to organize funerals for the dead?
Effie Latoudi told me that she's been involved in this for 5 or 6 years. She just felt that these individuals needed respect. But in the last couple years, where the numbers have spiked, it's become a really big operation to try and make sure that these people get the respect they deserve, some kind of proper burial, and of course that the loved ones feel that they can say goodbye to these people in a way that they can go on with their lives.
And I hear it's kind of at a crisis point. Is it true that on Lesbos they're actually running out of space to bury the ones who have died in the shipwrecks?
It's true. In the main cemetery here, they have run out of room in the area where they've been burying the refugee dead. And just today I heard from the office of the mayor that a nearby hospital has donated land. So they are now preparing that land to be able to receive the dead.
Jean, let's hear a little more from Effie Latoudi. Here she's talking about what she has to consider when she tries to organize one of these funerals or burials.
The important thing is to have people from the religion to give a proper ritual, because we don't know the ritual. And it's amazing to see them how they want to do it. The most horrible thing for them is to die in a place that you have no relatives and no one is crying for you.
Yeah, a place where no one is crying for you. A lot of empathy there. It sounds, Jean, as if those Greek residents of Lesbos are really invested in giving these migrants a proper send-off.
Well, certainly Effie Latoudi has been, and the group that she works with, and she was saying to me today that more and more people on Lesbos are getting involved and are really feeling this crisis and feeling these deaths. She told me that at the hospital the other day, she saw Greek people who were just there visiting their family or people they knew who they were sick, and they were just sobbing as if they had lost their own children.
And something she kind of hinted at there, Effie Latoudi also told you that many of the migrants really don't want to leave behind the bodies of their loved ones. Here she is again.
They are waiting to take them back to Syria. Some people, they are waiting to take them back to Germany or to Sweden, where they are going to be settled, which is very complicated. big bureaucracy, and it's a procedure that makes their grief even worse.
Jean, tomorrow, I gather, Lesbos residents are holding an interfaith service in memory of the deceased. Can you tell us about that? What's going to be going on?
Yes, at 5 p.m. around the Asia Minor Mother statue here, which commemorates the 1922 refugees on Lesbos, they will hold a large service, and there will be an imam, a Catholic priest, and a Greek Orthodox priest. And this is to honor the dead and also to cry out against the smugglers and against everything that is causing these very unnecessary deaths in the Aegean Sea.
Jean, where does Effie Latuti get that impulse to be so intimately connected with these complete strangers?
For her, it's a very deep instinct. It's very political. She believes that if the dead are not honored, then you're not honoring the communities that these people come from.
Reporter Jean Carstensen there on the Greek island of Lesbos. Her work is supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. As you just heard, the Mediterranean crossing can be a deadly one for migrants, and some are going literally to great lengths to avoid that route. For example, the migrants who choose instead to go through the Russian Arctic and into Norway. Reporter Charles Maines has our story.
At the airport in Murmansk, passengers file out from the morning flight from Moscow. Some hardly dress for the coming polar winter.
We are from hell, you know.
Tomasi is one of a fast-growing number of refugees from the Middle East who've procured tourist visas for Russia en route to Norway. Some are fleeing violence, others joblessness. But with word of the Arctic route spreading on social media, all have headed to Russia seeking a better life in Europe. And here's where an unlikely journey becomes a truly odd one. Russian law bans foot traffic at the border, and Norway fines drivers for carrying migrants across, meaning the only way to cross is by bicycle. And where to get one of those? Well, for that, there are guys like Kirill. Kirill is Russian, part of a web of, let's call them entrepreneurs, who sprung up around the Arctic migrant push, humanitarian aid for a fee.
No one's going to give them a bicycle for free, right? The drivers simply organize the route to make sure they don't get lost. They are just asking us to take them to the border.
The road runs 3 hours north to the small Russian mining town of Nikel. There, at a hotel, in fact, it's the only hotel, Syrians, Afghans, Egyptians, Palestinians, Iraqis, and others pack into rooms for the night, the vans outside loaded with bicycles.
It is crazy. I buy a bicycle. $200. $200.
Nabil is a Tunisian who moved to St. Petersburg last year after terrorist attacks collapsed his country's tourism industry. His plan is to shove out early the next day. The rest, he'll improvise.
I try to go to this Norway, and then I take my passport. I told him that the truth. I want to try new life here. That's all.
Norwegian authorities have been relatively welcoming, but the growing migrant wave is testing the limits of their hospitality. Rune Raffelsen is the mayor of Kirkenes, a small town just across the border. Police estimate more than 10,000 migrants may arrive by year's end, in effect doubling the region's population. Raffelsen sees the Kremlin's hand in this.
I think it's part of the sanction that Norway has been very active, and it's a kind of payback time.
Payback for sanctions on Russia because of Ukraine. Raffelsen can't help but note that neighboring Finland, which has warmer relations with Russia, faces no similar migrant surge.
We shall do as good as we can. And the only thing we need is to have an understanding from Putin and the government of Russia saying, this cannot continue. This is not right. You are not behaving right against Norway. We will have the right to use international law and could send them back. But of course, the people who are coming from Aleppo, of course they have right for protection.
That may be good news for Samir, a 28-year-old Syrian who fled Aleppo in 2013 for Russia, the only place he could get a visa. Samir speaks Russian now, but he didn't get asylum or working papers in Russia, so he jumped at the chance to get to Norway. The journey hasn't been easy, though. A Russian taxi driver took his money, then dropped him and his bike 37 miles from the border. Still, Samir says he made it.
Winner! Oh my God.
Outside a bunker-turned-refugee shelter in Kirkenes, Nabil emerges proudly holding his six-month temporary visa to Norway. After a few days' delay, he finally got his taxi to the border and biked into Norway, where officials promptly confiscated his wheels for failing to meet local safety standards. No brakes, no bike. He says he feels cold, but good.
Finally, Norway. It's a very good country. It's very, very quiet. But it's good. Look how house, very beautiful. Very beautiful house. Simple and beautiful.
Simple and beautiful. And if he can stay here past the winter, Nabil says he might even buy a new bike to ride around and take in the view. For The World, this is Charles Maines on the Russian-Norwegian border.
President Obama recently announced that some 6,000 inmates in U.S. jails would be getting released early. It's part of the administration's drive to adjust federal drug penalties and ease prison overcrowding. But more than 750 of these prisoners are not U.S. citizens, and that puts them at risk of deportation. Cesar Cuauhtemoc is an immigration and criminal law professor at the University of Denver. He says it will be quite tough for non-citizens to avoid deportation.
The difference for non-citizens, the difference for immigrants, is that they are instead being handed directly over to immigration officials and being put into the civil immigration court process where they will be detained while an immigration judge decides whether they have some legal basis through which to stay in the United States or not.
Does it make a difference whether the non-citizen inmates are documented or undocumented? Like, is deportation automatic if you are undocumented?
Deportation is almost never automatic under any circumstance. But I will say that it is much more likely that somebody who does not have the federal government's permission to be in the United States will end up being deported. Now, the tricky part is that there is no right to appointed counsel in immigration court, so they have to go in and hire an attorney. If they're not able to hire an attorney, then obviously they have a hard time making a legal argument up against the federal government.
Why not? Aren't these non-citizens entitled to a public defender?
Not in immigration court proceedings. The obvious answer is money. It obviously costs money to provide representation, but also I think the underlying reason is that we don't think of these migrants as being members of our community. We think of them as outsiders, as people who belong to some other country, when in reality, many folks who are in the United States who are not U.S. citizens have families. They have spent years, sometimes decades in the United States. Their livelihoods are here, their homes, their property is here. And so they are very much members of our community, whether or not we think of them as such.
Federal law says that when immigrants commit certain crimes, they face deportation. Isn't the administration just following the law here?
The administration is certainly just following the law. There's nothing legally questionable about what the administration is doing. The question is whether it's morally sound to put people into complicated legal proceedings without the benefit of a lawyer.
Cesar, are you confident right now that this process is going to be fair?
I am not confident that the process will be fair because without a lawyer, it's hard to make a legal argument. That is why we don't let people go through the criminal justice system without lawyers. We just can't expect that lay people understand the requirements of law or understand legal processes.
So, Cesar, what for you is the big conclusion from all of this?
The takeaway here is that we need to remember that migrants are part of our community. And if we are trying to reduce the adverse consequences of low-level drug crimes, then we have to think about the immigration consequences because these migrants may very well have families. They are part of communities here, and those communities are going to be deprived of their presence as soon as they are taken into immigration detention and being deported.
Immigration and criminal law professor at the University of Denver, Cesar Cuauhtemoc, thank you very much for explaining this to us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Marco.
And at PRI.org, a related story. It's about 500 immigrant women and why they're staging a hunger strike at a Texas holding facility. Coming up, terror in Little Saigon. That's next here on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like genetics, graphic design, and golf. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. In the 1980s, there was a string of murders that remains unsolved to this day. The victims were Vietnamese-American journalists with one thing in common. They tried to expose the inner workings of an anti-communist organization here in the U.S. called The Front. Reporter A.C. Thompson spent 2 years researching these murders. His work is part of a new documentary called Terror in Little Saigon, produced by our partners at Frontline and at ProPublica. Thompson says he started with a Vietnamese man named Dam Phong who had emigrated to Houston.
Dam Phong started publishing his newspaper. It was called Freedom in English in 1981. And he covered all kinds of things. He covered crime in Houston where he lived. He covered immigration issues for Vietnamese Americans. But he also covered a group called The Front. And The Front was basically a militia of Vietnamese Americans who said, we are going to start a guerrilla war and we are going to take back Vietnam from the communists. We're going to push them out. And we're raising money for it. We are buying arms. We are setting up a camp in Southeast Asia to invade. And Dam Phong thought this was crazy. He thought these people were, one, not really going to do it. He didn't believe that they were spending the money actually on war supplies. He thought they were pocketing some of the money. And he didn't believe the things these people were putting out, saying, hey, we've already gone into Vietnam. He would say, no, there's no evidence of that. In the days leading up to his murder, he was threatened by members of this group repeatedly. When he died, suspicion immediately fell upon members of the group. He'd been gunned down in the driveway of his home, shot 7 times with a .45 caliber handgun.
What did the investigation reveal? Was it the Houston police who investigated?
It started off being the Houston police, and at that time, they really didn't have any Vietnamese-American personnel, so there were language issues and cultural issues. They thought pretty early on that The Front might have been involved. Later, the FBI got involved and looked into the case, and they absolutely thought that The Front was very likely behind the assassination. And they even developed a key suspect that they thought was the person who had directed the assassination and had been in The Front.
But ultimately, the Front isn't prosecuted.
Exactly.
Why not?
Over almost 10 years, 1981 to 1990, 5 Vietnamese-American journalists get assassinated in the U.S. And in each case, there's suspicion that The Front is behind it. The FBI looks into this. They go around the nation, and they basically have that suspicion but can't prove it. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that they didn't make these cases a priority until 15 years after this terror spree began. And they had a huge amount of trouble actually getting within the ranks of this group the way you would with the mafia and getting people who really knew about what happened to roll and start talking about it.
We still don't know why or who killed Dam Phong for sure, and we may never know. Can you help us understand, though, AC, why this group of South Vietnamese vets, the Front, I mean, where does this existential hatred of communism come from? I mean, it's officially communist, Vietnam, still today, but it's really hard to tell. And we know from the great schism of the 20th century, communism versus capitalism, communism lost the free market. So what are these guys on about?
Well, part of it is to put it in the context of the time period. You know, this reign of terror, and there were threats, there were beatings, there were shootings, there were arsons, happens really between 1981 and 1990. And this is sort of the crescendo of the Cold War, right? So you've got the U.S. supporting insurgents in Afghanistan. You've got them supporting the Contras in Nicaragua. You've got them supporting a proxy force in the Civil War in Angola. And so I think for Vietnamese Americans, some of them thought, hey, maybe we can be the next insurgent group in this milieu.
There was also the thing that they're still doing it today in 2015.
Yeah, I mean, part of this is it was a thing that was absolutely informative to me, and I think this is about personal trauma in a lot of ways. I met so many people in Little Saigon who had spent 10 years in communist re-education camps, who'd had family members killed during the war, killed after the war, who had been forced to subsist on eating bugs in a communist prison. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely think that a lot of the ongoing hatred for the regime in Vietnam is a product of these personal traumas and horrors that people endured in the course of the war and after the war.
That was A.C. Thompson of ProPublica. His new Frontline documentary is called Terror in Little Saigon. It airs tonight on PBS stations. You can also listen to a longer version of my interview with Thompson. Just head to our website, PRI.org. Here's a question for you. What voice would you like to hear deliver the news of an impending nuclear Armageddon on the radio? Yeah, if there is enough time to make such an announcement. In the UK, the British government chose one man to record such a warning in case it was ever needed. He was BBC newsreader Peter Donaldson. You fans of the World Service would not have heard Donaldson. He only appeared on BBC domestic radio, but in Britain, he was quite well known. Donaldson died yesterday, and our man in London, Leo Hornack, has fond memories of him. Tell us who Peter Donaldson was, Leo.
Peter Donaldson is really the voice of the BBC, if you're British. He was the chief announcer, in fact, for BBC News for over 40 years. And so to someone like me who grew up in this country with the radio on, when you hear his voice, you can just sort of smell Sunday afternoon lunch being cooked. It's exactly that sense of stability and authority and a very kind of traditional BBC sound.
Tell us about that nuclear war warning. Was this just during the Cold War?
Yes, this was, you know, your classic War of the Worlds recording in a way. I'm sure the American government has exactly the same tape somewhere. In the event of a nuclear attack, there has to be something to tell people that it's happened. So they asked Peter Donaldson to record this. And I think we've got a little clip and you'll hear, you know, there's something quite chilling because the calmness of his voice is so deeply familiar to most British people. But that calmness with these words is quite a strange effect.
This country has been attacked with nuclear weapons. We shall bring you further information as soon as possible. Meanwhile, stay tuned to this wavelength, stay calm, and stay in your own house. Remember, there's nothing to be gained by trying to get away.
And let's just be clear, this is not happening. This is just the late Peter Donaldson giving that warning in the event of nuclear war. Does the BBC still have Donaldson's recording on the shelf, or does the Beeb just figure that when Armageddon happens now, we'll find out about it at BBC Breaking on Twitter?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is the thing. That was leaked. It was never supposed to be released to the public, but it got leaked soon after he recorded it. I think it's particularly the last line there where he says, "Remember, there is nothing to be gained from running away." I mean, that really sort of makes the hair stand up on your back, because I'm sure it's quite true.
Donaldson's death, Leo, has been pretty big news in the UK, I gather. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's the familiarity. I mean, it's one of those things like the weather, his voice, that as soon as you hear it, you know that you're in Britain, or as soon as you feel it, rather, you know you're in Britain. And he had that kind of relationship with listeners. I mean, I think an equivalent might be for public radio listeners, someone like Carl Castle. Apparently, Donaldson was very well known for, if people wrote in to complain about something they'd heard on the radio or the announcing, he would call the listener up. And so they would have this experience of the phone ringing and that voice, that nuclear warning voice, being at the other end of the phone saying something along the lines of, "I hear you have a problem with how I'm doing my job. How can I do it better for you, madam?" You know, and that gives a sense of his dedication to the listeners.
The World's Leo Hornack there telling us about the late, great BBC newsreader Peter Donaldson. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Residents of Rio de Janeiro's favelas know what they want from the police.
They want, you know, a police which is there to support them and to try to make the territory safe.
But is that what they're getting? Rio's so-called pacification program, that story's coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Soundworks.org, where you can find podcasts from PRI's The World, including The World's Daily Podcast and The World in Words with Patrick Cox, exploring language in all its glorious complexity. Subscribe at Soundworks.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Rio de Janeiro, that's where we're going for the next few minutes. It's a city that evokes all sorts of dreaminess.
The beach, the nightlife, the romance.
That's the trailer to the 2002 film City of God, which is set in Rio de Janeiro's slums, or favelas. The movie shows us the city's other face.
Bora, filhão. Não tem outro choro, não, meu irmão.
Aê, valeu,
the favelas where teenagers dare children to kill each other for the fun of it. Since 2008, the police in Rio have tried to contain the violence in the favelas, these so-called pacification programs aimed to create a calmer community-based form of policing. But that strategy has been the source of regular protests this year. Catherine Osborne reports from Rio.
Pacification wasn't supposed to lead to this. Demonstrators from Rio favelas chanting that pacification is just another kind of dictatorship. This protest followed the death of a 13-year-old, killed in the crossfire between pacification police and drug traffickers while he was playing soccer in his neighborhood. There have been several other deaths like that this year in Rio. And for those who study the pacification effort closely, that points to a program that has strayed from its original goals.
We should consider this kind of policing as a harm reduction strategy.
Harm reduction means a couple of things, according to State University of Rio sociologist Ignacio Cano, an early consultant for the program. First, acknowledging that people are going to buy and use drugs. Second, minimizing the violence and corruption that surround the drug trade. Put another way, says Cano, the police stay in their part of the neighborhood. The drug dealers stay in theirs. That way, kids can go to school and people can go about their lives without getting shot. And the police can become trusted for things like reporting thefts and domestic violence.
When you talk to people in the favelas, they want, you know, a police which is there to support them and to try to make the territory safe.
That's Julita Limp-Gruber, a sociologist at Cândido Mendes University who's closely tracked pacification. She says in 2000, a community policing program in the favela of Pavão Pavãozinho proved this strategy could work in Rio. That helped inspire the idea of pacification police units, or UPPs. But in the run-up to last year's World Cup, the pressure began to mount to expand the program.
Because of the World Cup in 2014, then all of a sudden, they began to create UPPs everywhere.
That stretched the pacification police units way too thin. And with the World Cup getting close, the Brazilian federal government decided to send in the army. Literally, it deployed army soldiers to take over a group of favelas called Maré. Supposedly, this was to prepare the area for the pacification police. But now that the army has come and gone, at a cost of around $200 million, there are still no UPPs in Maré.
Nada, não se viu pra nada.
Colonel Robson Rodrigues, number two in Rio's military police, admits the army occupation in Maré accomplished nothing, and that the lessons learned in places where security has improved are often not used to train new officers. Rodriguez is now trying to standardize training for all Rio police toward a new goal of firing fewer bullets during the workday, which underscores an even bigger challenge, changing the mentality of law enforcement in the city.
The war on drugs policy led us to mistakenly accept that we were going to war when there wasn't a war. We created all this in people's heads and actions, and principally in the police.
This year, in the supposedly pacified group of favelas called Complexo do Alemão, residents lived through 100 straight days of shootouts. In the favela Providencia recently, residents caught on video pacification police officers who had killed a young man planning a gun on the body to claim they acted in self-defense. The police also staged a struggle, firing two shots into the air after the young man's death. As Rio's big effort at community policing stumbles, influential names in the program are coming out saying that the war on drugs as a whole has failed and drugs need to be legalized and regulated. Colonel Rodriguez is in favor of that. So is Rio's state security secretary. Ignacio Cano, the sociologist who consulted on the pacification program, puts it this way.
I think we should have never started this war on drugs. I think it was a huge mistake with huge costs. When it's finally over, one day we will look back and we will wonder how it was possible that people devised those policies.
But that day won't come until police are held accountable for their abuses, says Cosme Philipson, a resident of the Providencia favela. He sees a lack of political will to tackle the problem. If nothing changes, says Philipson, police officers and favela residents, who both tend to be poor and black, will continue to die, while Rio pats itself on the back for what it calls innovative policing. For The World, I'm Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro.
Rio's racial divides are starkly highlighted by some new maps of the city. A Brazilian college kid, inspired by maps of Chicago, created the Rio maps using census data. And Will Carlos, with our partners at Global Post, has been checking them out.
Well, what they show is just extreme segregation in Rio's south zone. So you've got, first of all, they show that the population of these few neighborhoods is more than 80% white, which is completely out of sync with the rest of Brazil. And it shows that where there are people of mixed race or non-whites living, they're clustered together in very tight locations within these neighborhoods.
Is this just Rio? Can this data be kind of extrapolated out to the whole country?
I think it's hard to say whether it's, you know, whether it is just Rio or not. The experts that I talked to, the demographers that I talked to for this story, said that this is certainly the case. I mean, that there is absolute segregation all throughout Brazil. Not in the same way, though. What's interesting about Rio is that you tend to have people living kind of very close to each other. There is segregation, but, you know, all the way along the coast, even on these beautiful coastlines, you have these favelas where you have, you know, poorer non-whites living. And it's right next to some of the swankiest neighborhoods in Brazil. What's the case in other parts of Brazil is you've got segregation, but the favelas tend to be on the outskirts of the city. They tend to be away from the center. Basically, the cheapest parts of town is where you normally find the favelas.
Were you surprised when you first saw these maps? I mean, do the maps match up with what you see on the streets of Rio?
I wasn't really that surprised, to be honest. It was stark. It was interesting to see. But, you know, there's clearly segregation in Rio. There's no question about it. I mean, you go into some neighborhoods and people, you know, people have different color skin. I grew up in São Paulo. I lived there for 8 years when I was a kid. It's always been that way, that the elites in Brazil are basically, you know, white, and the wealthy people are, on the whole, white, and they tend to live in the nicest parts of town, in the most exclusive neighborhoods, and other parts of town are where non-whites live. It's just a fact of life here.
Brazilian politicians, though, portray their country as being a mixed place where race is not an issue. I mean, is that whole mixed place business a false narrative?
Well, and it's not just politicians, right, Marco? It's all levels of Brazilian society. The people that I speak to here say that they've grown up almost brainwashed into this idea that Brazil is this sort of racial paradise. It's this utopia where everybody lives together happily and everything else. And I guess this began in like the 1930s and 40s and has just kind of permeated to this day. Meanwhile, you know, you've got a Congress where there's one congressman who is non-white. The business and economic elites here are all dominated by whites. And, you know, it's just starting to become part of the political conversation here about whether we should be thinking about things like police violence, whether we should be thinking about things like economic injustice in terms of race here, as opposed to just in terms of sort of social inequality.
Yeah, so how can this data, how can these visuals actually change the reality on the ground, especially if there's only one non-white congressperson in Brazil?
I think what they do is they bring this conversation to the mainstream and they kind of make a mockery of this idea that everybody is living in harmony and that people aren't segregated. I mean, once you see these maps and you see how stark they are and you see some of the other illustrations that are out there, it kind of makes this pretense that Brazil is under start to evaporate and hopefully leads to kind of a more intelligent political conversation over these issues.
You know, we just heard from reporter Catherine Osborne about the pacification of the favelas and how the drug war seems to have just led to greater violence. Is this the same thing that we've seen in the U.S., like in Baltimore and St. Louis, just this enormous polarization between cops and blacks?
Oh, there's no doubt that there's a huge, huge problem, far worse than the United States when it comes to, you know, police disproportionately killing young black men. Actually, in Rio de Janeiro, over between 2010 and 2013, the police committed more than one out of every six of the homicides. And out of those homicides, four of five victims were under 29 years old and of African descent. So that just tells you just how stark the problem is here. There's this kind of canard that goes around in Brazil, which is that a dead bandit is a good bandit. And unfortunately, the stereotype in Brazil is that bandits are overwhelmingly young and male and black, and that it's kind of okay. It's kind of fine for police to go out and to kill them almost indiscriminately. And unfortunately, that's something that you see as pretty much a daily occurrence in cities across Brazil.
Reporter Will Carlos with our partners at Global Post speaking with me from Rio de Janeiro. Thanks very much, Will.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Remember the Iraq war? You know, George W. Bush, Saddam Hussein, and some dubious intelligence concerning Saddam's weapons of mass destruction? Well, you might also remember the name Ahmed Chalabi. He was the Iraqi politician who allegedly supplied that intel. Chalabi died today at his home in Baghdad. Jane Aaraf met Chalabi numerous times. Jane reports from Iraq for Al Jazeera America and the Christian Science Monitor, and she's currently in Erbil in northern Iraq. Take us back, if you would, Jane, to 2003 and Chalabi's role in providing the justification for the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq.
Basically, Ahmed Chalabi managed to persuade an American government, which was not difficult to persuade, mind you, that there were credible links between the Iraqi government, Saddam Hussein, and weapons of mass destruction. So if you fast forward a few years, he has on every occasion denied that he pushed the Americans into it. What he said essentially is that he introduced them to intelligence assets, if you will, and it was up to them to figure out who to believe. But what he did say was that the main thing he did was he made the Iraq issue an American political issue. And if you go back before 2003, that really was the extraordinary thing. He was very influential in passing a bill, essentially, that said U.S. policy was to topple Saddam Hussein and install a democratically elected government. And that's essentially what provided the legal basis, in American terms, for everything that came afterwards.
There have been so many things that have gone on in Iraq since the Americans left. I'm just wondering, it's probably very hard to say what Iraqis today, average Iraqis, think of Chalabi. But would you say that more or less he fits into that frame that anyone who isn't or wasn't Saddam Hussein is, no matter what their failings are, better than Saddam Hussein?
I think there is a much more nuanced view about Ahmed Chalabi in Iraq. He is again seen as an Iraqi nationalist. He's someone who has strong ties to the country. He is a secular Shia, but still his family was a very prominent Shia family. And, you know, in the early days, in 2005, he couldn't even win a seat in parliament. There was graffiti on the walls condemning him. A lot of that deals with the allegations of corruption, the allegations of fraud in Jordan. But Iraq in 2005 is not Iraq in 2015, and people have been absolutely desperate. They've been disillusioned with politicians, disillusioned with corruption. There really has been a feeling that they would deal with pretty much anyone if he could get them out of this mess. And so Chalabi essentially fell into that category. Now that he's gone, there is a wide outpouring of not just condolences, but seemingly heartfelt disappointment that he is gone, because he actually was someone who played a useful role, according to many politicians, in the Iraqi government. He was a technocrat. He was able to bridge that sectarian divide. And he had actual ideas about what should and could be implemented to help get Iraq out of this huge mess that it's in.
There were no WMDs, as we know now. If you're a U.S. veteran, should you be angry with Chalabi?
There is such a long list of people one should be angry with, I would think, about Iraq. I think one of the things we have to remember is that he persuaded the Americans to act, but nobody could have forced them to act, and he wasn't the only one persuading them to act. But yes, of course, there is a lot of anger at him. There's a lot of anger to go around, and he does indisputably share part of the responsibility for the invasion. He never disputed that. What he did was essentially lay the groundwork for the Americans to do what both he wanted and the Americans wanted, he said. But what came after, he said, was where it went wrong, both in terms of the Americans staying when they should have left, in terms of the Americans taking over the running of Iraq for the first few years, and also in terms of what has happened to Iraq since the Americans left. The story did not end the way that Ahmed Chalabi thought it would or wished it would have when he was first talking to the Americans.
Reporter Jane Aaraf speaking with me from Erbil in northern Iraq. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Up next, open the taps. The fountain is back on the world.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Marcello, come here. You know, that famous line from Fellini's film La Dolce Vita, delivered in the pool of Rome's Trevi Fountain. That is the Trevi Fountain today, and as you can hear, the water is flowing. That's because Rome's landmark fountain has been turned back on. It was closed for restoration for the past year and a half. Brandon Shaw runs the Roman Guy Tour Agency and likes to take visitors to the Trevi Fountain.
So yeah, this is about as close as I can get. I'm actually standing right in front of the fountain, about to get wet. It's just being cleaned, and it's the whitest I've ever seen it. You have to imagine a beautiful palace from the 18th century, all in white. And then attached to it is a fountain that goes down into the water with this natural rock formation. It looks simply amazing. It's by far the most beautiful fountain in the world.
So the stone is what?
The stone is white. It's a travertine stone, okay, coming from around 20 miles east of Rome, the same thing the Colosseum is made out of. And you have to imagine that it's a building from the 18th century, and the fountain has been literally superimposed onto that actual building itself, leading down into the water.
And the water must be just gorgeous, bright blue right now.
It's great. It's gushing out everywhere, nice and strong.
What's its history? When was the Trevi Fountain created?
The actual fountain we're looking at today would have been built in the middle of the 18th century. And the reason it was built, just like most other fountains originally, is because it stems from an aqueduct. So in ancient Roman times, you had 10 major aqueducts around the city feeding the actual city with water. And where you're standing, right where I'm standing right now, in the Trevi Fountain area, this was where the actual aqueduct itself ended.
Oh,
the
wow.
Terminus point of the Aqua Virgo, built in the end of the first century BC. So everyone would always come and get their water for the day and bring it back to their house because there was no indoor plumbing.
What a great water faucet, the Trevi Fountain.
Exactly.
The style is gorgeous Baroque, but its best modern association, of course, is with Fellini's classic film La Dolce Vita. Just describe the scene that put the Trevi Fountain in the limelight.
Well, it's the most famous scene. And of course, as a tour guide, we always go when we bring tourists here and we like to explain the scene to them over again. You have the beautiful actress, Anita Ekberg, who wades down into the water, beckoning Marcello to come inside as well and spend some time with her inside of this fountain. Of course, if you try and follow that today, you will be fined 500 euros.
Yeah, how many tourists don't obey that and actually try and reenact the scene?
I've actually known quite a few who have done it. And they do give you the fine. So please, no one jump into the fountain today.
Brandon, what are you hearing from locals and dignitaries there who were on site to see the fountain turned on? Are they pleased with the results?
It would be impossible not to be pleased with it. Of course, it took quite a while to clean it, and the questioning more or less is the timing of it. But, I mean, the result of it today is when you see it's beautiful.
I also understand that there's some resentment about the kind of stealth product placement that happened during the renovation. Apparently, Rome had to turn to the big fashion house Fendi to pay for it?
Yeah, Rome has kind of a tradition of not paying for things to be renovated. And so this is not the first case that we have where a big fashion designer has come in to actually go and clean one of the most renowned areas in the city. The same thing happened with the Colosseum.
Yeah, but Rome undertakes all sorts of building renovation and preservation. Does this happen all the time? They get a big financier to help out?
Oh, a lot of at least here, it wasn't as bad as some of the places you see in Rome, where billboards of the company sponsoring it is all over the place. Here, you had fences around the entire area. It was blocked off. But the actual word Fendi wasn't around as much as I think it could have been. Definitely could have been a lot worse.
So it's a tradition, as a lot of people know, to throw coins in the Trevi Fountain for good luck. During the renovation, I suppose nobody was throwing coins in the fountain.
In the beginning, people were trying to throw coins into the fountain, but obviously that was causing problems with the repairing. So they actually made a little tiny pool right next to it, and people were throwing over the fence into this little tiny pool.
The proxy pool.
It was pretty sad, but I mean, if that's all you had, I guess you had to go with it.
So did you get a chance to throw any euro coins into the fountain today?
Yes, it's kind of a tradition. So of course, we always go and throw coins inside. The money goes to a charity, so it's a good cause.
Brandon Shaw runs the Roman Guy Tour Agency in Rome. Thank you very much, Brandon.
Great, I appreciate it.
Let's stay in Italy and bring today's show to a rousing finish with a story of a rock and roll dream come true. This summer, 1,000 musicians got together in a small Italian city to perform this song, Learn to Fly, by American rockers Foo Fighters. The Italian musicians came from all over the country. The oldest was a 65-year-old blues guy, the youngest a 9-year-old drummer. But all of them descended on the city of Cesena near the Adriatic coast. Now, I'm no roadie, but the logistics of getting 1,000 people together to perform in sync is quite a feat.
The drummers were the hardest part of all because they had to play synchronized and they were in the space as big as a soccer field.
That's Fabio Zaffagnini speaking to our friends at the BBC. Zaffagnini was the brainchild behind this idea. He called it Rockin' 1000. Zaffagnini says it took about a year to get the project off the ground and it had one goal.
I actually love rock and roll and I love the Foo Fighters and I just wanted to see them in my hometown, which is a pretty small city northeast of Italy. And I knew that if I wanted to obtain this result, I had to create something special.
That something special became a video as well, and yeah, it went viral. At the end of this epic performance, Fabio Zaffagnini grabbed the mic and reiterated his dream.
Our call is to ask you, the Foo Fighters, to come and play for us. Come and play in here, give a concert to all of us in Cesena.
So, and did the Foo Fighters hear that call? You bet they did. Frontman Dave Grohl even responded with a video of his own in Italian.
Ciao, Cesena. Sono Davide.
Grohl said he loved the video and thanked his fans. He also made a promise to play in Cesena and told them that he'd see them soon.
Grazie mille. Ti amo. Ciao.
Soon is actually right now. Yep, the Foo Fighters have honored the request and Fabio Zaffagnini's dream.
Tonight we're gonna go and see the Foo Fighters in Cesena, and actually something really unbelievable.
As one fan tweeted, rock and roll can still be a miracle. That's all from us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, celebrating 50 years of excellence, by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage, and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, the Gruber Family Foundation, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, and the Harold Simmons Foundation. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund. And by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can.
PRI, Public Radio International.